Today, there are many discussions about identity politics in the mainstream of society. And those discussions are both about the pitfalls and the benefits of identity politics. As people are probably aware, the right now use identity politics as a term to refer to everything that they dislike and find repugnant in society, in particular, anything that's about combating oppression. So for example, last week, in response to China rightly calling out, China rightly calling out the torture that goes on in Australian refugee camps, Andrew Bolt, people might be familiar with him, inexplicably attacked China for exploiting identity politics by making this statement. A more accurate term, use of the term identity politics, came up a couple of weeks ago on the repulsive American TV show The View, sort of a panel talk shop show. And this time it was from right-winger Meghan McCain, who said that the natural progression of identity politics is towards race and gender being more important than your skill qualifications and the content of your character. And then she went on to pose the horrifying hypothetical that hosts of The View could in the future potentially be displaced by Asian Americans with no qualifications. The Twitter sphere then went crazy, pointing out rightly that her only qualification for being a host of this esteemed show is that she is the rich, privileged daughter of Senator John McCain. So this is actually, despite it being it's a right-wing example, this description of identity politics is somewhat correct in terms of what it's about. Identity politics is about groups of people who have a shared identity as part of an oppressed group, striving for representation in various institutions, on various platforms and spheres in society. Now, the most craven, unsupportable use of identity politics comes up frequently in electoral campaigns and from corporations, and it's extremely cynical in the way it's used. So, think of the last two US election campaigns. We had Hillary Clinton saying, "I'm a woman, vote for me." We had Joe Biden saying, "I'm friends with a black man, vote for me. And also I'm going to appoint Kamala Harris." Or you have the kind of corporate example where recently in the much publicized case and sort of public scandal, the executives of Bon Appetit dealt with their long established record of mistreating workers, including racist mistreatment of workers. They just dealt with that by putting more people of color onto their board of executives. Over here in Australia, we have the situation of Liberal Party women today waging the all-important civil rights campaign to get more women, quotas of more women, into the hideous institution that is the Liberal Party and to climb higher in the ranks of that institution. Or we have Rio Tinto in the corporate sphere. Rio Tinto, of the blowing up 46,000-year-old Aboriginal heritage site fame, initiating a new program to appoint more Indigenous workers and advisors to their firm. But of course, identity politics goes much further than just these cynical campaigns from institutions that obviously have absolutely no qualms with oppression. It's also a staple on the left. And I think it's been the dominant way of understanding oppression for quite some time now. I would argue that it's not a good thing that this framework dominates. It's helped create a situation where, despite millions of people being mobilized and motivated to combat oppression, there is actually very little discussion of the structures of oppression. There's been an almost complete embrace of the idea that personal experience is a substitute for politics, and there's very little serious engagement with strategies that are about ending oppression. So in the 1970s, the women's liberation movement coined the phrase "the personal is political." To express that, as well as being institutional and structural, women's oppression manifests itself in important ways in people's relationships and in private life. It was a way of saying the personal is also political. Today, the personal aspects of oppression are generally given the most focus. So the most widely discussed aspects of women's oppression are sexual assault and domestic violence. For trans oppression, there is a focus on the personal experience of being misgendered. Racism, I think, is a little bit different to this. The main question that has mobilized people around racism in recent times has been the systematic brutality by police towards Black people. But another key way that racism is discussed in society today is through talking about the phenomenon of unconscious racial bias shared by supposedly all white people and resulting in lots of microaggressions experienced by people of color. So rather than the approach that the personal is political, today we have a situation where across, you know, for many, the orthodoxy basically is the political is the personal. Now, the disproportionate focus on the personal and also the interpersonal tends to downplay other more structural aspects of oppression. So, for example, the gender pay gap or the huge levels of poverty that victims of racism suffer. It also downplays the conscious political attacks waged against oppressed groups in service of the status quo. So, for example, attacks that come from the conservative right towards trans people or the endemic racism behind law and order campaigns that are pushed by politicians. These campaigns do not stem from general unconscious biases that exist within the population at large. They are organized ideological attacks, which combined with the structural forms of oppression that benefit the capitalist system, create the basis for the interpersonal biases, prejudices, and mistreatment. Starting with the personal and the interpersonal means that this is often missed. Another thing it can do is disguise some of the key ways that oppressed groups are actually constituted today. Within every oppressed group, now more than ever before, there is a significant class difference. The mass social movements of the 60s and the 70s won a whole range of important formal democratic rights within the state for women, for Black people, for many other groups. And since then, one of the distortions we've seen of that, you know, those excellent struggles is the phenomenon of, you know, more Black faces in high places, as it's referred to, more women being part of boardrooms, the rise of a gay bureaucracy, and so on. And these class differences are important because they mean that there are fewer features of oppression that are generalizable to all groups or all people within one identity group. Today, being ruling or middle class, much more than before, substantially alleviates many aspects of gender and racial oppression, whereas being working class substantially amplifies them. Okay, the other aspect of the focus on the personal is the idea that understanding of particular forms of oppression is derived from experience. Now, those who have experienced a particular form of oppression should tell their stories. This can be an important part of filling in gaps in history, of taking on prejudice, of encouraging more empathy, and so on. And it's also undoubtedly the case that those who've experienced oppression can often be the most motivated to understand how it works and to invest themselves in the fight against it. But it is not the case that those who've experienced oppression are automatically able to understand it, in the same way that being cold does not provide someone with automatic insight into what makes the atmosphere cold, or more importantly, how to light a fire. And I think it's important to say that trauma in particular that's often experienced by oppressed people is not a positive, politically educative experience. It is not something that automatically makes people mentally or physically stronger. Recovering from trauma may do so, but definitely not automatically. Trauma can ruin people. It can pull them out of struggle. And we have to be for eradicating trauma, not elevating it to a political tool par excellence. And I think today, identity politics occupies the extremely dubious moral territory of confusing support for oppressed people with a valorization of oppression and trauma itself. Connected to this is the idea that lived experience, those with lived experience, are embodied with an unquestionable political authority, and that we just need to platform more people from these groups without any further questions asked. There just needs to be more representation, more platforming, and so on. I think in reality, this outlook is not a positive. It's actually tantamount to saying that politics doesn't matter. And I think that it completely trivializes the issue of oppression. So socialists are for always more people from more oppressed backgrounds having access to more platforms in society. But it is demeaning and idealistic to imply that oppression is simply the lack of particular voices in particular institutions or on particular platforms. Sure, the lack of these voices is often a reflection of systemic oppression, but the goal cannot be to simply get more people from a particular background heard or seen. It should be to actually challenge and overthrow the structures of oppression. And that is a task that will be addressed and thought about very differently from people from within a particular oppressed identity group. So because of this, any serious struggle to combat oppression will necessarily involve heated and ongoing political discussions about how the oppression works, what kind of world we should live in, and how to get there. And within every oppressed group, there are major political differences. So to take the easy road on this one, the Liberal Party women, they are not part of any sisterhood that anyone here shares. And even within their own decrepit, bigoted political institution, the women cannot agree that they all speak with one voice. Think of Linda Reynolds, calling Brittany Higgins a lying cow and so on. But Brittany Higgins herself is no hero. Despite the fact that she was a victim of a horrific sexist act, she is someone who's politically in support of a party whose social project is about attacking workers, including millions of women workers, attacking refugees, including women refugees, and so on. And these kind of divisions exist within every oppressed group. So one of the biggest questions in Aboriginal politics over the last few years has been the debate about constitutional recognition. In this debate, left-wing Aboriginal voices have argued against the empty symbolism and for meaningful treaty and meaningful reparations. Meanwhile, Aboriginal voices like that of right-wing lawyer and entrepreneur and crusader against welfare dependency, Noel Pearson, fully back the most cynical forms of recognition. And this debate led a couple of years ago to a delegation of left-wing delegates storming out of the Aboriginal conference that generated the Uluru Statement from the Heart. Not only did this incident reflect important political divisions in the Aboriginal community, but also it reflects that there are those like Noel Pearson, who is one of the defenders, of course, of constitutional recognition alongside Rio Tinto and many others in the establishment, whose voices get actively promoted in the media and throughout mainstream society. Those who, as Gary Foley says, are the A-team, handpicked, self-appointed Aboriginal spokespeople. And the reality is that within every oppressed group, there is not a level playing field. The voices that will get heard the loudest and those that have the politics that fit with the status quo and so on will be those that get promoted and pushed onto the majority of these platforms. Every single platform that we're talking about is a tilted platform. The parliament, the media, the academy, none of these are just even. And so the people that get chosen to represent Black people or refugees or whoever from an oppressed group will not be, a random selection. There will be those who come from the classes that are most associated with those platforms and have the politics that most represent them. Okay, the other way in which identity politics, I think, trivializes the political tasks involved with challenging oppression is the idea that everyone who does not suffer from a particular form of oppression must opt out of the political discussion or even the political fight altogether. So one of the Melbourne Uni student union office bearers recently said in an argument with socialists where she was angry that they were marching on the road, and she said that the most revolutionary thing rather than marching on the road that white people can do, mischaracterization of the socialist club there anyway, is to shut up. If white people or other people were to follow this advice, it would amount to a complete abdication of responsibility to fight this system of oppression and take seriously the question of how to win this fight. And I think actually the whole discussion stemming from identity politics about how to be a good ally is flawed from top to bottom. The whole discussion is about how allies need to come to understand that their supposed privileges derive from the oppression of others, and that their main responsibility in response to this is to deeply, you may say deeply narcissistically, examine their inner self, decolonize their minds, and so on. Actually, this is bullshit. It is self-indulgent and it's defeatist. Yes, people shouldn't be racist. People should challenge that. But we should aim for a whole lot more, honestly. More people should fight with passion and without apology against oppression. The aim should be to get more people off the sidelines, off the out of their navels and onto the streets. One of the most important figures in sparking the anti-slavery revolt in the US, one of the most, you know, all-important anti-racist struggles of all time, was a white man, John Brown. He sacrificed his own life and his children's lives in an attempt to begin an armed uprising in Virginia against the atrocity of slavery. Was he just a white man who should have shut up and stood down in deference to Black voices? Not according to Frederick Douglass, who said of John Brown's role in starting the Civil War, when John Brown stretched forth his arm, the sky was cleared. There was an end to the argument. The time for compromises was gone, and to the armed host of freedom standing above the chasm of a broken union was committed the decision of the sword. So pretty historically important. But look at something a bit more closer to home, the refugee campaign. It would be unimaginable without the activism of non-refugees. And it would be appalling to argue that non-refugee activists should step back from the struggle. Now, none of this is to say that oppressed people should not be the leaders of campaigns against their oppression. They should, not because of the moral weight of their experience being a substitute for politics, but because it's only natural that a section of those experiencing oppression are going to be the most motivated to fight with a particular energy and the best place to inspire others to build the movement. Think of some of the refugee resistance over the years and how deeply inspiring it's been, to activists and people across the world. But it matters what politics people who are leading have, and it matters that those who do not directly suffer a form of oppression weigh into the struggle and are involved in the fight. And for this involvement to be meaningful rather than patronizing, rather than self-indulgent, those involved actually have to take on the responsibility to engage in a serious way with the political and strategic questions raised. So another important concept to bring in here is solidarity. Solidarity is often conflated with allyship. And this is wrong. Solidarity is about acknowledging that an injury to one is an injury to all, that the same forces, the same politicians, corporate media, bosses, the police attack all of us. In other words, immediately, solidarity tells us that oppression comes from the capitalist class, that it is in their interests, and that it is against all of our interests. But to really understand solidarity, it's important to look not just at the reality of sharing the same oppressor, but to look at where power lies for our side. Solidarity deepens the power of our side because the more that workers see their interests as bound up with struggles outside of just themselves, other people within the working class and other social layers, the more chances there are for workers to use their unique social power, the power to stop production and to stop profits against the system. So when workers strike in response to a direct attack on them, that's important and that's one thing, but it is another thing entirely in terms of what it represents and the potential that it points towards when workers say, we haven't been personally attacked, but we should strike because this is an attack on our class and we can deal a blow to the capitalist class and the collective interests of their class by mobilizing. That is the most elemental power that workers have right there. And it's why secondary boycotts, strikes where workers literally do what I just described, are banned in many, many countries because bosses recognize that this is the biggest threat of all. Identity politics is the antithesis of solidarity. Even though left-wing people operating within the framework of identity politics will often throw around the word solidarity, in every meaningful sense, identity politics is about rejecting the social power embodied in solidarity. It's about elevating voices rather than smashing structures. It's about making space for more diversity rather than gunning for liberation. It represents fragmentation and retreat from solidarity. So it's no accident that the political framework of identity politics came out of the decline of the social movements of the 60s and the 70s and the beginning of a period, the neoliberal period, that represented a massive defeat for the working class in country after country. As the movements went into decline, thousands of activists, frustrated at the fact that it was no longer possible to generate mass activity, turned inwards, and politics became about consciousness raising within activist circles. This morphed into a policing of behaviours and the emergence of certain lifestyle approaches that were supposedly radical or revolutionary in lieu of any radical or revolutionary struggles going on. As the defeat of the radical upsurge was consolidated, many of these activists said farewell to activism altogether, to the working class and to revolutionary politics. And they found ways to politically and theoretically justify this. So post-Marxism, post-structuralism, post-modernism all emerged, and all were based on a rejection of so-called grand narratives, i.e. the idea that society is a totality that can be understood and that genuine social transformation is possible. Instead, under these frameworks, everything is a fragment, everyone is an individual, all with conflicting experiences and objectives. The personal is no longer an aspect of the political, it is everything. The politics of collective liberation doesn't seem possible, it doesn't even make sense within this framework. Now, this doesn't mean that everyone just became devoted to the most extreme forms of individualism and defeatism, but the fact that these were strong currents in the 80s that absorbed many former leftists, and the fact that the overall political context was one of defeats and setbacks for the working class is very important to understanding how identity politics was able to emerge as the hegemonic understanding of oppression. But the roots of identity politics are deeper still, and some of the political ideas that have become core to identity politics were developed within the social movements in the time that they were actually at their height, when they were healthy. And I think this is important to look at because it's not unusual on the left to find people who verbally reject identity politics, but embrace it in some ways at the same time. So firstly, I wanted to look at the term white privilege. And this is said to have been developed in the 1960s by Noel Ignatian and Ted Allen, two self-described socialists. In their pamphlet, White Blindspot, they argue correctly that there needs to be a united struggle against racism involving black and white workers, and that this struggle is also a struggle against capitalism. But they also argue in this pamphlet that, and I quote, the US ruling class has made a deal with the leaders of American labor and through them with the masses of white workers. The terms of the deal are these: you white workers help us conquer the world and enslave the non-white majority of the earth's laboring force, and we will repay you. So in other words, white workers are benefiting from the structures of racism and have similar interests to the bosses, even though the benefits that they get are relatively meager. Ignatian and Allen, in the throes of the struggles that they were part of, still thought that white workers could be won away from their alliance with the bosses, but that this would be appealing to them on an altruistic basis and cutting against their fundamental social interests. The theoretical idea embedded here is that the oppression of one group benefits a large section of the working class rather than just the capitalists. And it was common to the emerging politics of many of the social movements of the day. So the other major example is the idea of men benefiting from women's oppression. Now, one of the key reasons for this political idea developing was the failures of the existing Stalinist left at the time. Stalinism generally relied on crude economic formulations to explain how capitalist society is organized. And these formulations rejected any understanding of how oppression was integrated into capitalism. The Stalinist left also often had a conservative dismissal of radical struggle and struggles against oppression. And so activists involved in these new social movements were both, they came from and were influenced by a Stalinist framework, but also they were keen to reject some of its political conclusions, especially around questions of oppression. So they developed arguments that structures outside of capitalism were responsible for these other forms of oppression, white supremacy or the patriarchy. And this wasn't a major problem when people were in the heat of the struggle and were still drawing left-wing conclusions, but the seeds were laid for what would later become a more problematic and clearly anti-revolutionary strain of politics. The reality is that white workers share no social pact with white bosses. Male workers share no social pact with male bosses. In both cases, there is for sure the illusion of benefit, because the oppression of one group is severe and they experience their living standards being pushed down in comparison to other people. But this is not, and this is not to say that people shouldn't be made aware of those inequalities. If people are blind to those inequalities, that's a problem. People should be made aware of them combat them. But this needs to be seen as a series of disadvantages for the oppressed rather than a set of privileges for others. And this is important, and it became important because as these social movements started to recede and people's horizons about what they could achieve were lowered, the defensive argument began to emerge that the way to combat inequality was for more white people to give up their jobs, for men to take pay cuts and so on, rather than the much more ambitious aim and importantly, the correct one of trying to pull up everyone's interests and those of the oppressed in particular. This theoretical framework also suggests that through amorphous, invisible social pacts, white workers and male workers have no interest in challenging the structures of oppression that hold up capitalism. And in fact, that rather than seeing racist and sexist ideas as being against working class interests, it's precisely these ideas held by workers that play out in interpersonal interactions with others in the population that themselves are seen as the structures of oppression from within the identity politics framework. So by the time we get to the statement of the Kumbahi River Collective, written in 1977, which is the beginning of the decline of these social movements, this statement is where the term identity politics is said to originate from. And here we see an understanding of oppression that has emerged that roots it firmly in personal experiences of racism and sexism, and that sees everyone who does not share those experiences as part of the problem. So I'm going to read a little section from the statement because it's often referred to by people on the left in order to repudiate the degeneracy of modern identity politics and to assert that because the statement contains the rhetorical kind of claims of being for revolution and the writers are anti-capitalist and they talk about solidarity, I think misuse the term solidarity for the most part. It's said by some on the left that pure identity politics before it got corrupted by the likes of Hillary Clinton and so on, can actually be useful and revolutionary. And I think this is wrong, and I think it's a superficial engagement with the politics of the statement and the people who made up the collective. So I'll quote, "We realize that the only people who care enough about us to work consistently for our liberation are us. Our politics evolve from a healthy love for ourselves, our sisters and our community, which allows us to continue our struggle and our work. This focusing upon our own oppression is embodied in the concept of identity politics. We believe that the most profound and potentially most radical politics come directly out of our own identity as opposed to working to end someone else's oppression." So the revolutionary Marxist approach to oppression pushes in a completely different direction to this. Firstly, struggles against various forms of oppression have always been and will continue to emerge under capitalism. Capitalism is a social system that relies on oppression. The working class has to be forced to submit daily to the routine of exploitation. And this has to happen despite the fact that the class in question, the working class, has an inbuilt collective capacity to economically control and politically control society. And so to maintain this unstable compound, a whole raft of oppressive structures are necessary. And this in turn necessitates the construction of identity groups. So there is nothing that innately binds together women or Black people. These social categories only exist because there is sexism and racism in the first place. But once these categories do exist because of oppression, people start to assert their rights within this framework, often demanding not liberation from the identity category, but liberation for the identity category. And this is an important part of class struggle under capitalism. The very identification of people within a particular group of oppressed people can be the basis for them initiating struggles. It can inspire people and show that there are others who share this form of oppression, that there are hidden traditions of defiance, that there's a community of people who are striving together for democratic rights. So all of these struggles should be championed, should be taken as far as they can. Socialists support national liberation. We support trans liberation, Black liberation. And all of these are struggles that we are engaged with and want to push forwards. But at the same time, we have to understand the inbuilt tensions in these categories themselves and in the struggles that emerge from them. So firstly, all of these groups are divided by class. And this is an irreconcilable tension, not just because of the vast difference of experience within the group, but because the group contains layers with completely counterposed social interests. People in the ruling class actively benefit from the oppression of the rest of the group. This class distinction also means that insofar as the struggle of an oppressed group is confined to capitalism and rights that are possible under capitalism, the elites will get ahead while the others remain oppressed, and that is what we've seen. There is no possibility of universal liberation for the group, because even if some demands are met, and some forms of oppression, of course, do subside under capitalism, the bulk of the group will remain oppressed because of their class position. So to fulfill the demand for liberation for any oppressed group, and this absolutely should be the demand, we need to go beyond capitalism. No identity group except one has the social power within itself to go beyond capitalism. The working class, which is also a group created in order to categorize a process of oppression, is the only group that has the social power to end its own oppression, but also the oppression of all others. And this is because the working class runs society. Therefore, the struggle against their exploitation and their oppression is an elemental threat to the capitalist system. The harder workers fight, the weaker capitalism is. The working class as a class does not benefit from any of the structures of oppression that capitalism relies on. It has a permanent interest in dismantling them. And also, the society that workers have the social power to create, to replace capitalism with and create in their own name, is one in which there would be no social oppression based on racism, sexism, homophobia, religion, or anything like it. And that's because it's a class that can only rule democratically and collectively. So for these two reasons, the workers are the universal and the revolutionary class. But this does not mean that workers automatically take up the struggles of the oppressed, or that there are not big and ongoing political debates that need to be had within the working class, within movements, within society at large, to combat people's wrong ideas as an aspect of the way people experience oppression. But the starting point at the heart of identity politics, that oppression occurs because systems exist that are separate to capitalism and that benefit workers and bosses alike, is wrong and it's hopeless. This framework will always, no matter which way you spin it, lead away from liberation. But more than that, more than ultimately offering a dead end to in the sense of liberation, identity politics, with its narrow and its defeated political framework of the personal, of the moral, and of the low aim of more representation, plays the role of actively discouraging debate and serious strategic thought about how to eradicate oppression. It is the politics of taking discussions away from the terrain of any serious consideration of liberation. Well, to pick up on Louise's first point, I think it is important. The Kumbahi River Collective that I mentioned and read there from their statement, they are a group and were a group of people thoroughly middle class, and they were able to develop that statement because they went away on a retreat together, you know, to talk and discuss about their feelings and experiences as Black women in the US in a way that's quite distinct from the majority of Black women in the US at the time, you know, and their access to even being part of that collective in the first place. They are, most of them are still academics today, and most of the official voices speaking out about oppression from the framework of identity politics are in these positions. They occupy these platforms, as I talked about, that are weighted from the outset, that don't, you know, we're not just sort of decided by some kind of democratic process amongst the majority or within the heat of struggle, the kinds of people that would go on to represent the oppressed all throughout society. And the longer that this goes on, the more entrenched you have quite conservative layers of people derived from oppressed groups within various bureaucracies and sort of, you know, socially progressive NGOs and institutions, parts of the academy and so on, that actually do a disservice and push away from the kind of politics that are necessary to challenge oppression in a serious way. I think the other thing to recognize is that with struggle is something that does actually just automatically push against some of the worst aspects of identity politics. It opens people's horizons and it says, actually, we can aim higher than just having discussions about how this personally affects us. And it shows that there are serious alliances to be made, not just kind of, you know, moral ties of allyship and so on, as it's discussed today, but serious alliances that actually can have some impact and so on. So you saw that with the multiracial uprisings in the US around the Black Lives Matter movement, that it made sense that in order to have a bigger impact in those cities, people, you know, non-Black people should attend, should be part of those movements. But I think it's also important to say that just being for struggle or being against separatism, autonomism, and sort of for, you know, against sectionalism and sort of in a general sense is not enough. And we have to recognize that today the politics of identity politics casts a very long shadow. So in the United States, despite people wanting to succeed with that movement and push that movement forwards, there was no orientation amongst any of the leadership to how do we involve the organized working class and its particular social power. And that's important. Working class people, of course, were involved top to bottom because working class people are the Black population, are the white population that joined those struggles. But it wasn't automatic that people, you know, out of the kind of malaise of the 80s and the 90s, now we're in this new period where there is more explosive struggles happening a lot more frequently. It is not automatic that people just politically discard identity politics and people start to just understand the way that the organized working class can play a particular role, which it could have. If there had been strikes as part of that movement, it would have taken it to whole new heights. So that's something that is an intervention that the socialist left need to make. We actually need to argue against identity politics, not just wait for it to be sort of magically superseded by struggle. But then on the other hand, as Mick talked about, you can see that when struggles do take things to another level, when there are revolutions like we're seeing in Myanmar, the idea, how preposterous the ideas, all of the ideas actually of identity politics become within that framework. You know, they have to win. Their task is to win and people are prepared to die to win. The idea that you would stop, pause in the middle and say, well, have we got enough representatives from different groups on the front lines here? Like, it's just preposterous. And so it shows the more serious you become in your struggles, the closer struggles get to victory, victories against the capitalist state, the more these politics have absolutely nothing to do with what will take them forward.